Good evening, everyone, and thank you for coming to this Papua New Guinea Gender Parity Symposium. My name is Jenny Hayward-Jones. I'm the Director of the Melanesia Program here at the Lowy Institute. Gender equality is a hot topic internationally, especially in this week when we celebrate the International Day of the Girl Child. Gender equality is the fifth goal in the United Nations' new 17 Sustainable Development Goals agreed in New York just a few weeks ago. A recent report published by the McKinsey Global Institute found that if women played an equal role to men in labour markets all over the world, global annual GDP could rise as much as $28 trillion, or by 26%. Such an increase would be roughly equivalent to the size of the combined economies of the US and China today. Organisations and individuals in many countries, including our own and in Papua New Guinea, are stepping up their efforts to improve opportunities for women in the workplace. In PNG, we are seeing more and more women enter the corporate workforce, which is a significant cultural shift. But there is, of course, a long way to go before parity is achieved. This symposium is presented by the Asia Pacific Professionals Association in partnership with the PNG High Commission in Canberra and with the support of ANZ, Cardno and Ashurst Lawyers. In this panel discussion tonight, we're seeking to explore how gender equality could be achieved in PNG. We're looking at the main gaps and obstacles preventing women and disadvantaged persons from entering employment and how that can be supported to stay there. The symposium, which is being held in Canberra, Sydney and Brisbane, aims to encourage all players in Papua New Guinea to innovate and create the conditions that support gender equality. I'll start tonight's session by introducing our esteemed panellists, and then we'll go into a general discussion for about 35, 40 minutes before I turn over to you for general Q&A. The Honourable Malachi Tabar, MP, is the Minister for Higher Education, Research, Science and Technology in Papua New Guinea. He was appointed to this position in August last year, and from 2008 to 2014, the Minister was also a Commissioner to the Constitutional and Law Reform Commission. In no particular order now, Anne Steele over there is Head of Human Resources and Senior HR Executive, ANZ PNG. She has launched several initiatives to ensure there is gender parity in leadership and managerial roles within the bank, and she's an active member of the PNG Business Coalition for Women. Dr. Eric Kwa, just here, is the CEO of the PNG Constitutional Law Reform Commission. He has been at the forefront of women's issues in the area of law for the last 10 years and plays a leading role in the reform of laws for the advancement of women in Papua New Guinea. Magistrate John Kaumi, on the end there, is a District Court Senior Provincial Magistrate in Mendi in the Southern Highlands. In 2013, he became a formative member of the Male Advocacy Network, which aims to eradicate all forms of violence against women, and he is a valued champion for change. Avia Kwesen, just in the middle there, is the president of the PNG Women's Chamber of Commerce and is the founder and principal of Kwesen Lawyers in Port Moresby. She's a board member of Transparency International Papua New Guinea and has been involved in drafting the PNG government's Vision 2050 and also legislation to reserve seats for women in the PNG parliament. Dr. Linda Van Leeuwen, just here, is capacity building specialist and manager of Anitua. She manages Anitua's corporate responsibility program, predominantly its Elimination of Violence Against Women program. She's a founding member of the PNG Business Coalition for Women and other groups focused on addressing violence against women. I'll start with a general question to all of you and would like you to think about what you see as the key barriers to achieving better equality in Papua New Guinea and gender parity in the workplace. Perhaps we could start with Avia.
Okay, just before I answer that, I'd like to just generally say thank you to the Australian Asia Pacific Professionals Association, Emily Franklin and Kylie, for being such a warm host to us and sponsoring us to come down. They've looked after us very well. I'd also like to thank the people who have been behind the scenes in funding this particular trip, this roadshow that we've had. The gold sponsors are the platinum sponsors are the ANZ Bank, who have kindly been able to allow a bit of funding to this, and also the gold sponsors who are Cardno and Ashurst. So thank you to you all for making it possible to come here, for us to be able to say the things that we feel are very important to the development of our country, and gender parity is one of them. Sorry, if you can repeat the question again.
Could you name one or two key barriers that you see in place in Papua New Guinea that prevent achieving gender parity or better equality?
It's quite a complex question because we come from such a wide diversity. Gender parity, traditionally, we have about 900 different cultures. So in some cultures, mostly along the coastline, that was very well regulated. And gender, the woman's place was, she grew in her status as time went by, being a mum and then a grandma and so forth. In some other cultures within our country, they were always in the kitchen or with the pigs in the backyard. So traditional culture itself, at one point in time, the breakdown of it, the shift into modern culture, has placed people, a lot of cultures in no man's land, really. When women are now moving out of homes and going to educate themselves, moving into positions of earning power, economic power, sets off some insecurity. Women are no longer in the backyard, they're in the traditional form. Also, we have institutions that have come about as a result of being westernized, and you have the law enforcement agencies, but you have people there maybe with not the mind shift. The culture shift has not taken place. So there's a number of reasons why, generally, and social issues such as drinking. Alcohol never used to be part of the culture. It's now part of the culture. That's leading cross-cultural marriages, because we have so different cultures that are clashing. So the order of family is also, I think that those are some of the reasons why there's that issue.
Thanks, Savia. Minister, would you like to offer a view?
Thank you, yes. In a very difficult country like Papua New Guinea, and especially in the education sector, we've had some major disparities, I guess, on the lower level of education, trying to sustainably improve the mindsets and the understanding of children at that level. Due to the many and frequent changes and reforms, but also the inability of some families and the decisions at the micro level, family and households, as to who goes to school, economic conditions were just not enabling our girls to be preferred to go to school. It was always the boys. Over the last few years, and the government that we are in now has made some major, major changes. Elementary, primary and secondary is heavily subsidized by government, and the numbers, the figures today, effectively see a very good proportion of girls as against boys in our primary and secondary schools. But prior to that, it was that situation, and it was just difficult. Our figures, especially at the higher institutions, the universities, it is still on a 0.68 index, or 60-something, nearly 70% that are male of the intake to universities and the graduates after university. We hope through this, and again I stand with everyone here for thanking the sponsors and people who've made it possible for this to happen. We would like to highlight this. We would like to be part of some major programs that will effectively go down to family units, households, both the father, the mother, and the children growing up in the house, to try and understand and participate fully in their responsibility to helping us with this. Thank you.
The two main issues that I see in PNG that affects gender parity is allowing access to wealth for women. How women will be able to economically empower themselves. For me, if we are able to provide those opportunities, then our women will be able to break forth and will be able to take control of their own destiny. The second issue that I see is the lack of awareness in terms of the responsibility of the man over his family, over his sisters, over his children, girl children. So for me, those were the two main issues. From the legal perspective where I stand, where there are gaps in the law, we've been addressing those issues for the last couple of years, and we continue to address them. But on the ground level, it will, from my view, it boils down to allowing women, even men, to empower themselves, both economically and socially. In that way, they will be able to engage in some meaningful activity that will then distract them from all these issues that confront them every day. And so, for me, it's if we're able to focus our energies, our efforts to addressing those too many issues, maybe we will be able to help eliminate or reduce gender parity in PNG.
Thanks. John Kalmi, would you like to?
Thank you. Let me answer this, your question, by starting this way. Gender-based violence was not an issue in my country in the old days. It started gaining notoriety 30 years ago. And the irony of this is that is when we started becoming more educated. Our cities became more cosmopolitan. There was this large drift, urban drift to the towns. And the breakdown in culture, as Ivy has alluded to, has contributed a lot to this. And there are various factors, because culture always changes. And one significant factor was, and I don't like to say it, but it's education. The more educated we became, the more economically powered we became. So where in the olden days we had our chiefs, our big men, with the advent of education, people getting more education, going up in level, being paid much more, they had the money power to dictate how things went in the village. Now, what you have now is there's a generation of people in my country who no longer know the customs as they were then. And that is why I, as a male advocate, firstly, I mean, a magistrate, second, we've been advocating, and there's a group of us in the country, there's 30 of us public servants, a government initiative that we have in the country, and sorry if I'm sidetracking, but it's more to the issue here. We have, the government has an official policy called JESSI. That's the acronym for Gender Equity and Social Inclusion. Now, coming on the top of this was this move or initiative, or it's a white ribbon initiative, to have public servants, male public servants, gender synthesized and form a network to assist what is already happening in our country and to assist what our sisters are trying to do to alleviate the problem. And from the training I've received, I see that there is a great need for gender synthesizing in the country. In the public service, there's 39,000 of us. Of this total, 37% are women. So you can already see the disparity here. We need and because there's 39,000 of us, this is an opportunity that can be used. Now, it comes to a second issue, which I see, our second reason for the issue we have in our country, and it's the manner of planning that has been happening. Your country here, other countries who have assisted our country with funding, it's all appreciated. But after 40 years of independence and the rates of GBV, they seem to rise. There's no downward turn in the rates. This should be, you know, those should ring alarm bells. What is happening? Have our efforts, have our contributions to this country, have they been bearing the kind of outcomes that we want? There is advancement in a lot of fields. But what I'm suggesting is to complement what we already have in the country, we need to revisit how you are assisting our country. And to me, it comes with planning. I've worked and lived most of my life out not in Port Moresby, and recently I was up in the Highlands, a remote part of our country in the Southern Highlands, and I lived and worked with where polygamy was the norm, not the exception, and violence was the desired method of disciplining one's spouse. And what I saw is just given me more, it's given me this drive to see that there should be gender sensitivity. There should be a change of planning. We need, instead of planning from Port Moresby down, we should be bottom up. We should be going down to the wards, to the villages. Because if the statistics as they are point to where the problems are, which are in our rural areas, and which is where 82% of our people live, then logically, if that's where the problem is, if that's where the survivor is, if that's where the perpetrator is, then we should be going there. We should consult them, and we should strategize with them, and come up with strategies to address the situation. That's my take on the situation.
Good evening, everyone. I'm here to represent a business perspective, and even though I have been invited as a representative of the resources sector, what I have to say is applicable across every sector. And if we're looking at barriers to gender parity, and when I think about gender parity in business, I'm thinking about, you know, even numbers of women employed, women represented across all different occupations within an organisation, not just as the cleaners and the caterers and the admin people, and most definitely at every level within that organisation. So that's my definition of gender parity in the workforce. But Magistrate Cowmie has touched on gender violence, and gender violence is most definitely a significant barrier to gender parity in every country. And in certainly you can look at it in terms of women entering the workforce, but I guess what I want to focus on is keeping women in the workforce and ensuring that they are developed and trained and supported and promoted so that they do climb those ladders within the organisations and end up in significant leadership positions. I just want to explain very quickly, if I could please, why or how gender violence is a barrier to keeping women at work. And it relates very much to what you consider to be a good employee. Good employees get promoted. So people who turn up to work on time, they always turn up, they don't take days off. People who are extremely productive and focused and efficient. People who go the extra mile for their employee, they work back late, they work on weekends. They're all characteristics of good employees. However, if people, whether you're a male or female, if you have violence in your life, it's actually quite difficult to be a good employee. How do you turn up to work, for example, if you're so physically injured you can't actually get there? You may well be in the hospital or at home trying to recover. You may be so ashamed of the physical signs of that violence that maybe you could actually turn up and do your work, but you're ashamed. Your psychological state to turn up and to be productive, to focus, to make decisions, to concentrate, to plan, the mental health toll of violence is incredibly high. Thinking about going the extra mile for your employee, working back late at night when security concerns are heightened, when there's no safe public transport. Or no public transport at all. If, you know, the car park is not safe, if you're fortunate enough to have a vehicle of your own or a company vehicle, if there's very few people who are also staying back late, so that heightened sense of poor security again. So all of those factors make it very difficult. Even if a woman is not experiencing violence, the threat of violence is ever present and a very much a reality in many places in Papua New Guinea. All of those things stop women from being good employees. And if you're not seen to be a good employee, what chance have you got of being selected for a mentoring program or a training program or a leadership development course, all of those things? So that's one reason I think that we have problems with parity in PNG. It does relate to violence. Thank you.
Dr. Kaur, I'd like to ask you, particularly in your relation to your role as CEO of the Constitutional Law Reform Commission, you're aware, of course, of studies by the World Bank, the UN, Australian Government, the ADB, detailing major gaps in gender equality in Papua New Guinea. But it's not all a terrible story. PNG has made some very positive strides in combating gender inequality in recent years, and the CLRC has done some amazing work in reviewing laws to address gender parity. Could you tell us a bit about the process that you lead and what reforms you've been able to influence with your recommendations?
We've done a number of things at the Constitutional Law Reform Commission. I'll just give you a quick rundown on some of the laws that we have pushed through to Parliament to address gender violence and gender parity. The first one is that we actually recommended to government, and the government actually, through Parliament, repealed the Sorcery Act, because sorcery and sorcery-related killings became a very big issue in Papua New Guinea. It continues to do so, but we saw the Sorcery Act as a license to participate in very violent acts against, in our findings, vulnerable women, and including vulnerable men. And so we recommended the Parliament to remove the law so that the perpetrators would be charged under the criminal code based on the criminal elements that are already provided for in that law. So that was successfully done. In relation to rape, we actually participated in the discussions that led to the reintroduction of the death penalty in terms of rape. We suggested that the women were raped, particularly girls under the age of 10, who were then killed or murdered, the perpetrators would be sent to death. Again, it was a response to the growing concerns about violence in PNG. We have also now go through Parliament the amendment to the replacement to the Lookout and Picketing Act, the Child Welfare Act. That particular act now provides a lot of protection for children, and particularly a girl child. One of the things that we have now succeeded in getting in Papua New Guinea is to ban child marriages in PNG. So every child will now, we hope, with the free education policy by government, they can all go to school, and they remain in school until they're 18. So a child can only be married if they turn 18. We made it an offense for parents, guardians, who force their child to marry before 18 to be criminally liable. Because we think that we must allow the children to continue their education. We have also, through our office, we drafted, and it was passed in 2013, the Domestic Violence Act, which we call the Family Protection Act. That basically outlaws domestic violence, not outlaws, but makes domestic violence a criminal offense in PNG. We have defined the violence, domestic violence, in three main areas. First is psychological violence, and so if you're a man and you're getting drunk and you come home and every time you abuse your wife through abusive language, you will be charged for domestic violence. If you are stalking, you'll be caught for domestic violence. If you assault the woman, you'll be charged with domestic violence. One of the key interventions that we made in this law is that we have now tried to provide a protection to the woman and the children, particularly when the man assaults the wife and then chases the wife and the children out of the home because he is the owner of the house. In the Family Protection Act, we have said that if the man is the perpetrator, that he leaves the house, the wife and the children stay. they won't be put out on the street. The other proposals that we are now putting through is in terms of the Marriage Act. We're not trying to protect customary marriages. So under a reform to the Civil Registration Act in 2014, we have now made it mandatory for customary marriages to be registered. By registering the customary marriages, we are now saying that a man can register only one wife. And so if you are in a polygamous relationship, then you have got to decide which of the many wives that you have will be your legal wife. That comes with the issue of inheritance. So the person that is the woman that is being chosen as the lawful wife will now have access to the inheritance of the husband, and the children will have it. So the next question that we have is then how do we deal with the children of the other wives? And so we're now looking at reviewing the Wills and Probate Act to try and protect the children of the other wives. But in terms of the wife, it will be the wife that the man chooses to register. That would be the legal wife. We are now also challenging the issue of polygamy. We have tried to take it through to Parliament to ask the Parliament to make a law prohibiting polygamy in PNG. But that did not get a good reception in Parliament, and so we have now taken it to the Supreme Court. Supreme Court is like your High Court in Australia. And so we have now gone straight to the High Court, asking it to declare that polygamy is unconstitutional because it violates against women, and it affects women's rights. And so we have now filed a Supreme Court reference. We hope to get a decision early next year. So we are waiting patiently to see how the court will rule on our application on this particular matter. Another proposal that we have put forward before government now is to amend the Divorce Act, Matrimonial Causes Act, which we borrowed from Australia. It's an Australian law. In Papua New Guinea, we now realize that a lot of the wives are not working. They're mostly from the villages, and they get married to working husbands. And when they're divorced, they lose out on everything. And so we are now suggesting that the wife's contribution towards a family also equates to an economic contribution to the assets that the husband has. And so in divorce proceedings, the wife will have equal right to the property. In that way, we give protection to the women and her children, because sometimes the man then marries another wife, and then the second wife now, and the children take on the property and the assets of the husband. And so we've tried to provide some opportunity for our women who are, as I said, mostly not working, those who are from the village but have got husbands who are more economically powerful than them, to try and see if they can also share their assets with their wives. So those are some of the things that we do, and we're doing a couple of things at the same time now. Hopefully by the end of December, we will now already have identified all the laws in PNG that we need to reform to comply with the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. So hopefully by next year, we will push through a number of legislative changes to ensure that we comply with CEDAW in the next 2 or 3 years.
Thank you. Turning to the corporate sector, and still, ANZ has a very positive story to tell on gender equality, including that 12 of the bank's 15 branches in Papua New Guinea are managed by women, and that more than half the bank staff are female. You're the head of HR. Can you explain the initiatives that ANZ has taken to improve gender parity, and what lessons have you learned from them that might be relevant for other businesses in PNG?
Thank you. Proud to say that we've done a lot of hard work to encourage women to actually grow in their career, aspire up the corporate ladder, and it's basic stuff. Like, we've put policies in place to make sure that women are actually taken care of, as well as the minorities. So when you talk about minorities, it could be the disabled, yeah? So specifically for women, we've got policies around remuneration, benefits, training. You know, remuneration is an interesting one, because men tend to think that they come in with experience and sort of get a higher salary, and women will come in and start at the lower rung. But our policies are quite set in place where we all start, you know, at the same level, dependent on your level of experience, education, and so on and so forth. So we've got specific policies in place that protect our women and make sure there is no discrimination at all across the organization. There's also initiatives in place to ensure that women are motivated, encouraged to put their hand up for bigger roles, and what we do is support them through the process. So we've got coaching, mentoring programs in place. We form this little group, and it's driven by our PNG women, called Banking on Women. What we did, the leadership team, was select firstly the talent women, you know, that we consider talent, but also opened it up to the rest of the organization to say, you know, look here, if you're interested, feel free to join. And it was initially just to encourage our women to sort of get out there, speak, you know, grow their public speaking skills, encourage networking. And then as we grew over the year, we then sort of branched off into focusing on leadership programs. And so what we see is women are now stepping out of the lower graded roles. So of course we've got 600 employees, and of the 600, close to 400 are women, but we found initially that they took the lower, the roles that were sort of considered lower end of the rung. Today we've, you know, across 100 managerial roles, I'm pleased to say we've got at least 45 women sitting in that category. At the very senior level, the team that runs the country business, we've got 40% women, and of that, two of the women are PNG nationals, but four from the Pacific. So really good stats for us. So that, you know, the program that we put in place is working. Interesting, I think, for us also is we get to go out as well. So because we're bankers, we see that it's part of our corporate social responsibility to actually go out and empower women as well. So we have close to 40 women in the organization that are accredited trainers for money-minded programs or financial literacy program. We go out and run those programs for women in the community, and we work through our customers, and these would include our large corporates as well as our medium to small corporate businesses, right? So we run money-minded or financial literacy that's proven really successful, because we find that women in the community do a lot to actually sustain their family or the livelihood for their family. So we've also tiered that program and taken it up to another notch, where we run another program for women or for people in general who want to start up small to medium-sized businesses. So it's telling. We can see the results coming out, but really pleased to say that women are now progressing and taking up managerial roles and senior leadership roles in the organization. ANZ as a whole, like, the group policies are in place, so it's leader-led, driven by the CEO, Mike Smith, the group CEO. So we have a pledge in place where every single member of the senior leadership team pledged to recruit one woman, so into a managerial role. So when we advertise roles, we've got to make sure that before you sort of appoint someone, you go through a formal recruitment process. If you don't have a woman put up her hand for the role, you've got to go and hunt for, you know, go out and look for women, encourage her. And then on the interviewing panels, make sure you have a female representative on that panel as well. So we start with the basics recruitment, make sure that it's, you know, not, we've removed any element of discrimination or bias. We put our people through unconscious bias training, so that helps a lot. We also do, on the governance side, we make sure that our numbers are tracked. So the stats are reported on a quarterly basis. So, you know, I'm pleased to say, like in PNG, we had at least 8 women promoted last year, in the last financial year, which is great for us. So 1% could be small, but it's quite big. It makes a hell of a big difference, and it does sort of motivate our local women to put their hand up for bigger things. So it's driven by the senior leadership team, and supported. We've also got budget set aside for any diversity initiative, anything to do with promoting women, just building their capability, building their confidence, upskilling them to take up senior roles. We invest in that, and we also get them to sort of go offshore and do stints there as well. So Melissa's a classic example, who's come from Octedi Mining, but's now our head of legal and compliance, sits on the management board. She joined us 2 years ago, and as part of her role and my role is to make sure we coach and support our women to sort of do better and bigger things as well. So,
thank you.
That's just one little bit of it. I could go on, but I think I should give someone else a chance to talk.
Minister, responsibility for improving gender parity in the workplace must start with the education system. Can you tell us what your government is doing to achieve equal participation between the genders in tertiary institutions?
Well, thank you. Yes, there is this strong commitment, I guess, on the part of education to improve the understanding and competencies of our younger generation. The department that I now head is effectively 1 year old. April 2014, this department was brought into existence. It basically transformed itself from what was the Office of Higher Education, the Commission of Higher Education, and one of our panelists was Ms. Koysen was a commissioner in the Commission of Education. We've effectively got Parliament, and Parliament last year brought us to be the Department of Higher Education, Research, Science and Technology. I was brought into this position around August last year. To answer the question, two levels of our educational program, the lower primary basic education level, we would like to make sure, and the government over the last 4 years have made some strong financial commitment through heavy subsidies, and the intake has been good. From our end, we are also encouraging that basic level to do a good job and make sure those students are properly looked after. And by the time they sit for their grade 12 examination, which is basically going to be next week, we find some better qualified people on merit who can be accepted into university. But to answer the question of helping them to understand, as we bring in a lot of people, and especially putting them together in a classroom or in a school, we have this task on our hand as teachers, as people administering the institutions, to make sure that there is responsibility to respect and live by the rules of the institution, the law of the country, to make sure we do not abuse, we do not. And I will say this, coming from different cultural settings, the students today are still having some problems. There are boys' schools, they don't have any female, and I came out of one of those schools. Two Saturdays ago, I had to bring in the alumni group of that school, effectively invited me, and the message that I gave to them, the father as a watchman, always house. And basically I encouraged the boys who are now working, younger families in Port Moresby. This is in Port Moresby. Our school is on an island on New Britain. These workers in Port Moresby. Basically, now that you've graduated, you've got a job, you must make sure you do the right thing. You are the role example, the role model. If you break up this family and you go out and leave the children and the wife, your son is going to do the same. If you abuse their mother, your daughter, people within the house, your son is going to be the same. And he can be a policeman, he can be but he's lived up with, he's come out of that house where abuse and problems were the norm, is going to do the same. So in our lower primary sector of education, we are still having some difficulties. And these are inherited into our higher education institutions. Unfortunately, as you go into medical school, law school, or some other major faculties of studies in our universities, it is now difficult. And over the last 2 weeks, before I came down this way, we had one of our universities, the police basically told me off, they have broken the law of this country, they have to go to jail, they have to be in court, and if the court decides that they leave, they leave. So that's where we are, and I've told them, that's the law, you have to go. 9 students have to be terminated, discontinued from class. They don't like it, and they mobilize themselves, the old students, that's how they, the norm is that they can mobilize and basically stand together as a student's union and argue for, but the law has found them guilty, and they have to go. So we are moving, we are seeing some improvements in intake, and especially the girls in elementary and primary and secondary, we would like to make sure we bring that into our higher learning institutions, technical and universities, and we can graduate some good, competent people who will help run the message as they become public servants or workers in their respective institutions. Thank you.
Thanks, Minister. Avia, as president of the PNG Women's Chamber of Commerce, what do you think the chamber can do to encourage better outcomes and gender parity in the private sector? And in your role as a lawyer, what do you think can be done in the legal sector to improve those outcomes?
Okay. Firstly, I'll answer the legal question. As a practitioner, I've been practicing for over 23 years, and in my practice, I come face to face. It's very confronting with domestic violence situations. There's not many of us women lawyers, so women will come because they want another woman to help them, because the other woman will understand what they're going through. That's first reason why they come. Secondly, because you're a lawyer, they run to you because they know you can help them and understand their situation at the same time. The difficulties that I've faced trying to assist women who come forward with domestic violence situations is when we get, firstly, the law enforcement agencies are insensitive. When we get to a police station, the perpetrator is usually there already. He's already compromised the policeman. So when we get to the police station, we don't know if we're the perpetrator or we're the victim, whether my client is the perpetrator or the victim. She is the victim, but she's treated like she's the perpetrator. And secondly, as a lawyer, I don't get, my position to defend my client is not really respected because I'm a woman. So it's double trouble. We have to, you know, we have to first deal with this policeman who's not gender sensitized, to know that there's a situation, it's unlawful, firstly, for the man to beat a woman. It's an assault case. Secondly, it's an emotional case for the woman, and there's a lawyer here representing that woman who's been battered. So it's a really, really confronting situation. There are cases where there's been gun, this one particular husband had a gun, and he was kind of showing it off as we were at the police station, and the policeman was turning a blind eye. In another instance, I didn't know if the wife was more scared than I was. We were both so scared because the policeman was shouting his head off and he had a gun. And he was making it look like the wife was at fault. But she was the victim and she was supposed to be pressing a charge. And that statement just never got written because we were arguing with the policeman all night as to who was wrong. So those kind of things, and the threat, the indirect threat of you representing this particular client is gonna, you're gonna get thrown into the cell together with the client. So those are real situations that we face when we try to defend. I cannot speak for male lawyers, but I'm speaking from experience of what I go through when I take my clients down to the station. Very fortunately, our legal system is still intact in the sense that when you do get to the courthouse an IPO is given to you straight away. There are now systems in place where you don't have to appear in court. You just go and fill out a form. So we teach the ladies, you just go to the district court, get that IPO form out, you fill it, instantly you have an interim order. So you can serve it on him, and then we'll appear in court and argue the case out. So that's one good thing that's happening at the district court level. However, at the police law enforcement level, I understand there's that donor is, a lot of funds are being used as donor funds to help our law enforcement agencies, and I think they need to be used a little bit more wisely. Maybe we need to relook and review how we are helping these policemen to carry out law enforcement, especially in domestic violence situations, because I think that the mind shift has not taken place yet for many policemen. So maybe a lot of that money can be used to gender sensitize our police force. But in our discussion in Sydney, we did say that it is a bigger problem in that you have to go back to the family situation when the child is younger, because these policemen are already grown men when they join the police force. This is not a symptom that they're introduced to. They've already seen it. They're insensitive to it from home. So it comes back to education. And we've been discussing that in our roadshow, that education is the key to teach this young man, this young boy, while he's in school, to respect the fact that the female is also an equal citizen under the Constitution. Our National Goals and Directive Principles talk about equality and participation. Those are things that we can include in our school curriculums to gender sensitize our young boys as they grow up. You know, I'm just saying this from my heart. I feel that's the answer. It's not a quick fix. It's not. You have to start from when the child is young, teach them values that are going to make them understand that the female is also just as has the same rights under the Constitution as a male person does in Papua New Guinea. They have rights under the Constitution, and they should be treated with respect. So that's from the legal perspective. I also think, in my opinion, that the more women legal lawyers are taken up in the hierarchy in the judiciary or they are promoted in the corporate world, that also will bring a message to many people about gender equality, because right now we don't have it. There's only a few women judges. We have 5 out of 39 women judges, and those 3 were just chosen 2 weeks ago. So we've always had maybe 1 for the last 20 years among 39 men, and now we've got 3 more added, so there's 4, not 5, 4, in the last 40 years. So there's a very, you know, basic imbalance there, a gender inequality at this point in the legal profession. And women who are graduating out of law school, we now have an equal number that are coming out of law school, but not making it up the ranks. And one has to ask why that's happening and maybe address those issues. I'm from my opinion, I think it's because we do have gender inequality in representation in court, in the courts as well. There is bullying by the male judge. Those are things that are very sensitive, and I should just say them, but we can discuss them further if you know need be for statistics. However, those are things I've also experienced as a courtroom lawyer. There's not enough women in court. And you have to have that number there, because then you'll have the women coming up and asking for legal help, and they can get that help. Right now, there's not many women practitioners in the courtrooms. We need to ask the question why that's not happening. So that's from a legal perspective, from the client's perspective and the lawyers. With the PNGWCCI, we're a young organization. We're still a baby, about 2 years old. We've had our first elections less than 2 months ago. So we're still up and, you know, trying to get ourselves organized. But in the last 18 months that we've established ourselves, we have been able to work we've now got our constitution in place for our members to join us. We've worked from, started from 6 members. After 2 years, we've now got 260 members who've joined us. We are running courses to empower our SMEs. We're concentrating on small businesses to try and get economically empower our women. One of the major issues why there is domestic violence in the culture right now is because with this shift, men have always been the leaders in leading their, looking after their families. So families will always encourage the men to be educated and go and earn money. Whereas the wives, the women, that there's no value there, where women have always been discouraged. Certainly in my generation, we were discouraged. Even I was. So I had to fight my way to get to where I am now. That's why I really believe in education. Minister, sorry, can't overemphasize that. But it's changing. It's changing. There's a shift now. And there's a shift now because the girls are showing, the few girls who are educated have shown that they are bringing the money home to prosper the families and help the communities. I'm not being gender biased here, sorry men, but that's what's really at the bottom line. The few girls who have been sent to school, they do show that they are responsible. Not all, but some of our men who are sent to school don't have that kind of thinking. So the money is for sometimes for alcohol or to go out and play a game of pokies or to enjoy themselves with their mates. So that's now shifting, it's changing. We've got now more women in school. But 80% of our population still remains in the rural areas where there's no education. So our women are still in the backlog, in the back, you know, pedal there. They are doing everything they can with this shift to try and survive in towns and in the village as well. When you come to Papua New Guinea, you will see so many women sitting on the roadside selling cheese pops, drinks, anything, cigarettes, Digicel credit cards, to make our money so that they can go home at the, in the afternoon and feed their families. What the Chamber is doing and has started doing, we have started running programs with the help of the American Embassy, who are giving us technical assistance to run programs such as how to save, how to open a bank account, how to register your company, how to turn your hobby into a business. Right now, as we speak, we have just joined partnership with the Australian Business Volunteers Association, who are running a one-month program teaching women on how to draft a business proposal. So those are the things that we are doing. I must say here that we are not funded. We're an NGO, not-for-profit organization, so we're starting from scratch. The Americans are helping us to set up, give us advice on how we should set ourselves up. And I must say here, we have just found our office space for the first time. We've been operating out of my office. you got to have passion and heart to do these things. So we've been operating out of my office, but we have been very CPL group of companies have been very kind. We've approached them and they've said yes. They've given us an office space. We have now approached JICA for office equipment, so we should be set up by the end of this year. Fully set up as an office and have an executive director employed fully, full-time, because we're all part-time. All of us are women and we're doing it part-time. We already do have our own jobs and this is an extra job we're doing. But like I said, the drive is because we have passion to help other women. So we have the government for the first time this year granted us a grant of $150,000, which we have now already committed to the employment of an executive officer who will join us early next year, who will now run our office full time, so we can run more programs and help more women. Besides that, we have now the Americans have now assisted us kindly to employ someone who is going to run a business center, which we will be overseeing. So these are things that we are doing along the pipeline to assist our women who are to economically empower them so that they have a bit of earning capacity. Financial independence is so important because most of the reasons why there is fighting in the household Domestic violence occurs because the woman has no money. She cannot look after her children. She cannot provide a meal. Because many times the husband is irresponsible. But if we can make her economically independent and she's working to earn that money, then she doesn't rely on him. She's more happier that she has a bit of money in her pocket to look after her children, to send her children to school with lunch money or someone. And that just eases out a lot of the frustration that happens among families that leads to a lot of... And also it brings her status up, you know, and we're addressing the issue of gender inequality in that way. That's what we do.
We are just almost on time and I haven't exhausted all my questions yet, but I am very keen to give you all a chance to ask some questions. So if you can all stay for a few more minutes, I will turn over to you now. So any questions?
My name is Mazi Singh and I'm Consul General of Papua New Guinea, based in Sydney. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak. Let me thank all the speakers. Speaking from the traditional Melanesian tribal culture, having constitution guaranteed the customary law as part of our constitution, Schedule 1.2. But same time, you got the human rights guaranteed by constitution, and especially a Section 55.2 giving rights to women. I want to pose that a holistic approach. When you have a golden egg, there is a golden egg, and if you have a mother, you have a child. I'm from a mother, and if there was no mother, we wouldn't have this earth. Where do we start in terms of designing policies and politics to give strength to all the laws that we are talking about? And in this direction, I want to ask Dr. Kua, can we all make all the women be politicians and prime minister so that we don't have to fight for policies and change the laws? Thank you.
That's what I really want. I really want a woman to be a prime minister, and we've been pushing that for the last almost 10 years now. Ms. Koshien and I were with the government trying to transform the law to allow women to go to parliament. I was a chairman and she was my committee member. We were advising Prime Minister Sir Michael Somare at the time. It was difficult. It was difficult. We worked for 2 years trying to assist the government, bring proposals to change the constitution to allow more women into a leadership, political leadership. We didn't succeed. Why? There's so many reasons. Why we couldn't get it through. And I do not intend to go through all those reasons. But let me say this. At the provincial level and at the local level, we have done well. Because we have got women, politicians, sitting at the local level government. In every rural local level government, we have two women who are the two reserve seats, and they're appointed to the local level governments, and they sit there for 5 years. At a provincial level, we have a women leader who sits on the provincial assembly as a nominated member. So we've been having that for the last 25 years. So really, it's at a national level, at the national parliament, that we lack the numbers. But at the provincial and local level, we have always had women leaders. They're for a long time now. Unfortunately, people, when they look at PNG, they look at the national parliament and then they think, well, we need to target women in the national parliament. And they don't look beyond the level of national politics. And when you look beyond, you'll find a lot of women leaders there. 22 women sitting in 22 provincial assemblies, and you got two women in almost 600 local level governments. So you've got a lot of women leaders sitting at those levels. We do not think the battle has been lost. We're thinking we can be able to start renegotiating with the current government because it's the current prime minister that actually assisted the bills to go through parliament. And the constitution was amended. Constitution was amended to create 22 seats for women. Unfortunately, the enabling legislation, which is the election law, that was the one that was not approved. And so we fell short. But creating the seats for women, it's already there. The constitution provides for it. Unfortunately, to get into parliament, you must be elected. And that is the electoral law that we failed to amend. and we're hoping that we can be able to restart the negotiations. But Tumasi, we are not the only ones who are going through these difficulties. I think many other countries are also going through similar challenges. And for me, it's about finding innovative ways to try and address many of these issues. I've seen over the last couple of years, working with gender for almost 10 years now, I've seen a lot of improvements in Papua New Guinea, particularly at the grassroots level. At the grassroots level, there are a lot of simple women, men who are rising up to address these issues. Maybe at the formal level, we might not be doing as much as we think we should. But at the community level, there are a lot of very successful and interesting stories about women who are rising up and trying to take a stand against this, I call it the nonsense, of gender violence in PNG. And I've also noticed that in the corporate world, they're also coming forward, and they're supporting the government in doing their own small things. I mean, like ANZ, we have Digicel, we have Westpac Bank, we have City Pharmacy, and we have got ExxonMobil. They're doing a lot of great things in their own little way, trying to address the issue of gender parity. From the government, it's only in the last 5 years that they've really picked up on a number of policies and strategies to deal with this. And so I have hope, and we just need to keep chipping away until we break the wall down. And I don't think that's going to be far.
One thing I'd like to add on to what Dr. Kwa has said is that when we were doing our campaign across the country, it was just before election time, and we were campaigning for these 22 women's seats. On the back of that, rode three women into parliament. So even before that, law, even though the law failed, only in one small aspect, three women got into parliament as a result of the campaign. So I think we've succeeded, non-legally, but we will succeed legally. We haven't stopped fighting.
Hi, I'm Janice Sengupta from Aon Hewitt, and my question is, what consideration has there been on either the part of government or corporations to take initiatives that will make the workplace safer for women? You know, for example, having safe buses late at night, either sponsored by a company or by the government.
Thank you so much for that question, because the business context, I want to thank you for that, but also the safety context as well. There are a lot of businesses doing a lot of different things, some big and some small. Unfortunately for us as a corporate sector, not very coordinated, but we've definitely made a start. The company I work for, and I, Anitua, we're a 100% PNG-owned company, which is very significant, and we have a reputation as being the leader when it comes to the PNG business community in addressing gender violence. I'm not going to talk about what we do, though, because you can read about it. There's a flyer at the back. But companies in the resource sector who are showing incredible leadership are Oil Search, for example. They have just established a women's protection and empowerment unit, and we're expecting great things from Oil Search. If you look in the agricultural sector, because I appreciate not everyone's interested in resources, New Britain Palm Oil have been plugging away for a very long time at a community level and getting their women to decide how to make their workplaces safe, and fundraising and doing wonderful things in terms of buying equipment for the hospital in terms of babies' health. There is Digicel, I think you mentioned that, Dr. Kwa. Steamships also showing leadership in the area. Safety, we had an IFC-funded or hosted lunch today with representatives from all sorts of business houses that have major operations in PNG attending. And one of the messages that I wanted to get to those businesses is that gender violence, irrespective, occurs at work at home or somewhere else in the community does need to be treated and reconceptualised as a workplace safety issue. If you are physically impaired or injured through violence and turn up to work and try to operate machinery, lift heavy pots, work with chemicals, operate any kind of machinery in a factory, you have the potential to be a safety risk to yourself, your colleagues. And if we look at mining and women operating, you know, multi-million dollar trucks, certainly the potential to damage that equipment. Your mental health impacts your ability to work safely. You have to focus and concentrate to work safely. In the resources sector, we have some of the most sophisticated workplace safety systems and frameworks that you'll see anywhere. Resource companies have huge capacity to treat gender violence under their OH&S frameworks, and we are slowly starting to see a little bit of a mind shift when it comes to workplace safety and mining and gender violence. And I do need to commend Newcrest Mine with their Lihir operation. Someone sent me an email the other day trying to find some statistics on this, you know, how many women are actually injured at work due to gender violence episodes. No company collects that data, but I'm really hoping that they're about to start to. So there is some movement in that area. And the other thing, there's a group of businesses now have got together, PNG Business Operations, and have developed with the assistance of the IFC and also the University of New South Wales highly respected Gendered Violence Research Network on pulling together and developing products to assist PNG workplaces make their workplaces safer and more supportive. And I can certainly talk to anyone interested in those products. It's an exciting time to be working in the gender violence business space in PNG.
We don't have any others. I might wrap up, and I'm going to ask either Emily or Kylie to step up in a minute. But our speakers all have time to stay a little longer after we conclude, so if anyone wants to stay back and talk to them, you're very welcome. We have conducted this event in full cooperation with the Asia Pacific Professionals Association, whose idea this very interesting concept was, and I'd like to invite Kylie to come up and say a few words.
First of all, we'd like to thank the Lowy Institute for facilitating the panel discussion this evening. We hope that you've all enjoyed it. And thank our speakers who've taken time out of their personal and professional lives to actually come down and travel with us on our roadshow to Canberra, Sydney and Brisbane. It's been fantastic. The Asia Pacific Professionals Association is a networking organisation. We exist for our members, and so people can join and they can become a member, so you can be a company or you can be an individual, and we strive to meet our members' needs. So if our members say, we want something about domestic violence, we work to put something together. If we want something about gender parity, we'll work to put something together. So if anyone has any questions about what we do, please come and have a talk to Emily and myself. And of course, we thank our sponsors as well. ANZ is our platinum sponsor. It's ANZ PNG in particular. Ashurst Legal, law firm that also works in PNG, and Cardno, who do a lot of amazing work. And we also have a number of other supporters as well. And thank you very much.
Thank you, Kylie. Can I ask you all to join me in thanking our very eminent and very interesting panel speakers tonight? I certainly have learned a lot and know how much there is more work to do now, and I'm sure you've all benefited from this discussion. Thank you very much.